Charlotte Talks is sponsored by Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to bridging the gap between adventure and adventurer by helping people select vehicles that fit one's lifestyle. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Charlotte city planners are in the midst of rewriting the city's outdated zoning codes and updating the comprehensive plan, and they're doing so with an eye toward racial equity and upward mobility. In many cases, it could be argued that zoning is one of the major reasons we have difficulty in achieving upward mobility and seeing improvements in racial equity. 20th century zoning codes, combined with federal policies, restrictive deed covenants, and redlining practices, all helped perpetuate racial segregation and led to the dearth of affordable housing we're experiencing in Charlotte today. But city planners have come up with a bold and, some might say, controversial idea. The end of single-family zoning. Going forward, you could see a mixture of single-family homes sitting next to duplexes, even quadruplexes. Mayor Vi Lyle spoke about this on Charlotte Talks on Wednesday.
Look at Dilworth, right through it. Aren't there quadruplexes next to single-family? Aren't there duplexes? In one of our most established neighborhoods, Foxcroft, there are duplexes on the corners. We are just trying to capture a way to have people have affordability at every price point. And we have pretended as if this is something new, when I think if you read Jane Jacobs from back in New York City, where she said front porches are the most important thing that you can do to build community, we're talking about the opportunity to put more housing in more communities. So, yeah, I'm absolutely supportive of this.
And that's not going to change the character of neighborhoods?
I think it will change it for the better. I think that some of our most prized neighborhoods reflect that.
With us to talk more about this idea is Taiwo Jioba. He's the planning director for the city of Charlotte. Welcome back.
Thank you, Mike.
To help us understand how zoning has impacted us and how it resulted in creating roadblocks to upward mobility that we're still suffering from today, Tom Henchett is here. He's a community historian in Charlotte. Welcome back.
Good to see you.
Brian Larry, welcome back to you. He is president of commercial and mixed use for Crescent Communities. Thank you for joining us.
My pleasure. Good morning.
And because Minneapolis, Minnesota has already made this move in an effort to address that city's affordable housing crisis and to confront years of racist housing practices there, we invited Heather Worthington to be with us for part of the program. She is director of long-range planning for the city of Minneapolis. Thank you for being here.
Good morning.
Good morning. I hope spring has arrived there. That's all I can
say.
Well,
no. We had snow last night, so no.
Oh my. Well, I'm sorry for you. As I did research for this program today, Taiwo, it surprised me that stories about Charlotte considering this have appeared already in the New York Times and the L.A. Times, and I think in a local paper in Minneapolis.
Yes.
I've never seen anything about this idea in our paper. Did I miss it?
Yeah, you missed it.
Okay.
Because Danielle, Charlotte Observer, actually wrote something on this a couple weeks ago.
Okay.
Yeah.
So we've known for years that Charlotte doesn't have enough affordable housing, and that housing here is that what we do have is disappearing fast. Since the study on upward mobility was released, showing that Charlotte was at the bottom of the heap and hitting that hit us square in the face with the fact that if you're born poor in Charlotte, you will likely die poor here. So ever since that time, city leaders have made it their business to do something about this. At the time, did we think that these two things, the lack of affordable housing and the lack of upward mobility, were connected in some way, period, and then also connected into how we zone?
I'm not sure at that time it was obvious to a number of people, because on the surface, it wasn't. Mm-hmm. When you think upward mobility, you always think about accessibility to jobs, income. But historians like Tom have always connected the dot on this, that, you know, because of the way that we were going back some years that have really segregated our communities, it has something to do with upward mobility. On the surface of it, most people were not tying land use issues or zoning regulations to that. But most planners recognize that. And so that study actually also recognized that as well. that if you're born in a particular zip code where you don't have access to full service grocery stores or good quality of schools or can even access hospital or medical facilities quicker or maybe delayed fire or police response to issues, that was connected to, you know, the upward mobility issue for people.
And the fact, because of redlining and practices that we'll talk about as we go through this program, Tom, people in those communities are in those communities largely because they were unable to and prevented from building wealth.
Right. The array of regulations and policies through much of the 20th century made it easier for some of us to buy houses and made it harder for others of us.
Well, made it possible.
The key thing for wealth accumulation.
We're going to talk about the particulars of all that in a few minutes, but Charlotte is considering adopting this policy to address this, the ending of single family or the changing of single family zoning. And this is something that Minneapolis, Minnesota has already done. Heather, you implemented this in December. What led to it? Why?
The City Council adopted our comprehensive plan 2040 in December, and that was an effort to try and get at exactly what Taiwo and Tom are talking about with regard to wealth creation, access, and agency. So access and agency are these dynamics that we know lead to better outcomes for people who are living in poverty. And if you have access to grocery and transit and good schools, you typically have a better chance for upward mobility. And it also is about agency with your local government and being in places that are highly amenitized and highly engaged.
Your city council voted to eliminate the single-family zoning category altogether, as I understand it. And I think you're believed to be the first major city in the country to approve this citywide. Was this a sudden decision? Was it something that that's been percolating in Minneapolis for a while? What exactly led leaders to first investigate making this decision and then taking the plunge? Because it was almost unanimous.
Right. It was a 12-1 vote. Many cities have looked at this in the last decade or so. Few have been able to get this far. I know Grand Rapids also has some similar zoning changes that they implemented about a decade ago. What we said was it's important to do density incrementally. So to allow access to these highly amenitized areas, you could take one of two approaches. You could allow some density through a duplex, triplex type of approach, or you could allow for larger apartment buildings to be built. We thought a more gradual, incremental approach would be helpful in terms of change management.
And do you, like Charlotte, have older neighborhoods where this is already in place and was in place? Nobody thought anything about this in the 1930s or 1920s. Do you have neighborhoods like that in Minneapolis?
Absolutely. Starting in the early 1900s, the development pattern in Minneapolis was very much about a mixed housing type development. So we had duplexes, tris, quads, small apartment buildings next to single family homes. It wasn't until the 1930s that you really started to see the implementation of single family zoning, primarily to the north part of the city and the southern part of the city where there's a lot of park amenities and lakes. And so that was how the city eventually put zoning practice into the racially restrictive covenants that had been in existence for probably about three decades at that point.
So Minneapolis has done this citywide. Charlotte is in the beginning stages of talking about what we might do in this direction. Other cities have done this in a piecemeal fashion. The entire state of California is looking into this. Is this coincident? Is it something in the zeitgeist? Why are all these places looking at this today, Taiwo?
So there's what Malcolm Gladwell, right, called the tipping point. So we get to that point where you see a lot of things happening: crisis of affordable housing, upward mobility issues for us, people, quality of education, folks. Discriminatory practices. You get to traffic issues, you know, like you experienced this morning. You get to this point in your evolution and your development as a city where you begin to look at different options to make sure that you increase the supply of affordable housing units, to make sure that you talk about preserving the character of neighborhoods, but how do you have integrated neighborhoods? Because there are studies out there that actually says that single family development produces more traffic than multifamily development because they are mostly located close to areas where accessibility to transit is possible, walkability, you can bike and all of that. So when you get to that tipping point, you begin to look at different things. Like Heather said, this is not new to us. I mean, look at our neighborhoods. Like the mayor said yesterday, Dilworth, Plaza Midwood, Elizabeth. These were practices before now, but we moved away from there. And as this crisis began to just combine to really stifle urban living and livability, we had to look at different options to get out of it. So this is one of those tools in the toolbox, I should say.
Heather Worthington is with us from Minneapolis. She's director of long-range planning there. And Heather, talk a bit, just a little bit about the inequities that you saw and Minneapolis leaders saw between many black and white residents, which you say date back to the 19-teens in Minneapolis.
Well, we have a long history of segregated neighborhoods in Minneapolis, beginning in about the 1930s, and certainly after World War II, with that generation of enormous wealth creation after World War II, we know that our people of color in Minneapolis were left out of that wealth creation. And so what we've seen is today in the demographics that we look at primarily through the American Census Survey work, we see that people of color, in particular African Americans and indigenous people, are at the absolute bottom of every measure. And we are not proud of this, but we have the deepest racial disparities in the nation. And we're working very hard to reverse that because that is not an economically sustainable position for Minneapolis in the future. And it is not a just city.
Hmm. Take us back just briefly, Tom. We've talked many times about how Charlotte was, at least following the Civil War, relatively integrated, people living side by side, rich and poor,
absolutely,
black and white, etc. And then things changed at the beginnings of near the beginnings of the 20th century on both sides of the divide. Why?
A combination of things. I wrote a whole book about it called Sorting Out the New South City, about how Charlotte became segregated. But a key thing nationally was a sense in the progressive era, as it was called, that if you had a place for everything and everything in its place, life would be better. And the notion of sorting things out, categorizing things, ranking things was very important. And when there was an economic upheaval in the 1890s, a depression, people were looking for ways out of that. And as often happens in times of economic stress, one of the tendencies is to blame people, and blaming African Americans became quite popular.
So what happened in Minneapolis that Heather just talked about also happened here.
Right, right.
And it's been that way ever since.
Yeah. The notion of an exclusive neighborhood, I never thought about that term, but it means a neighborhood that excludes. And in 1901 in Charlotte, the first restrictive covenants went into deeds in the new streetcar suburbs that said this property shall be used only by members of the Caucasian race, but also for a house costing not less than X number of dollars. And so the notion of single family, the notion of income matched neighborhoods began as a sort of a grassroots thing in the law books and then was reinforced with redlining in the 1930s.
So, Heather, we only have a minute left in this segment, but you say your city has not touched zoning since the 1990s. Does that make this process more difficult or in some ways easier?
You know, I think this process would be difficult either way. We certainly have a lot of work ahead of us to update our zoning code, but I think this level of change is challenging to manage for cities. And so I think that this has to be done in an organized sort of incremental way so that you can bring people along as you make these changes. These are difficult changes.
And when's the last time we did a major overhaul, Ty? Well, I have 20 seconds.
For our zoning
Charlotte,
code?
For zoning, yes.
That was like 1992?
So we're about the same. We're comparing apples and apples here. When we come back, I want to ask Heather where Minneapolis is in this process and where they intend to take it. And then we'll talk exclusively about Charlotte and what you're considering right now, how it affects the development community and more. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Charlotte Talks is sponsored by Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to drivers that believe a car is used for more than just getting from place to place. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about what Charlotte is considering with regard to single-family zoning as they work toward their new master plan, and that is a major change with regard to how we zone what have historically been single-family neighborhoods. Taiwo Jayoba is the planning director for the City of Charlotte. He's here in our studio along with Brian Leary, who hasn't said anything yet because I haven't asked him anything yet, but I will. He's the president of commercial and mixed development at Crescent Communities. Tom Hanchett is a community historian in Charlotte. And Heather Worthington joins us from Minneapolis, where she is director of long-range planning. They've already done this. Their city council voted 12-1 to eliminate citywide single-family zoning. Where are you in the process at this moment?
So we're in the process right now of establishing the ordinance that will basically enact this land use regulation that the comprehensive plan calls out. And then we are also doing a couple of exciting things I want to mention. One is we're doing a study of the missing middle housing types, so that we can make sure that these products are built in these areas. So we're working with AIA Minnesota to issue some design regulations and guidance about that. We're also working with ULI Minnesota to
You'll have to forgive me and explain these abbreviations.
The Urban Land Institute, American Institute of Architects, yeah. So we're excited because the message I want to get through here is that what's important is that you can regulate this, but you have to make sure that the market can respond to these changes. And one of the challenges we have in Minneapolis is that we have developers who build large-scale projects and build single-family homes and nothing in between. And so we don't have a practice that's built up in the Twin Cities to build this type of product. So that's what we're trying to do, is also encourage this product to be built. But we have a lot of interest so far. There are a lot of people who either have a lot or would like to convert an existing property. So we have a lot of interest, but we just need to help provide some guidance in that area.
Well, you've opened the door for Brian Leary to join this conversation. What about Charlotte? Does Charlotte have developers? I know you're a developer. Mm-hmm. You work for a developer. But in general, do we have developers who are equipped and ready to build this kind of product, something that's not a five-story block-long apartment building or a single-family home, something in between?
I think we do, and I think we actually have them already doing it opportunistically in places like Plaza Midwood or maybe even in some places in the South End. And as we mentioned earlier, they've been built historically in places like Myers Park, and the mayor is even quoting...
Why isn't it being done? Because the zoning doesn't allow it?
It's being done ad hoc in a few places where a single person can come in and do 2, 3, 4 units, maybe 8 units. And so in many ways, it's kind of, I wouldn't say sneaks in under the radar. People don't see it as a threat necessarily. And it's generally not in the heart of some of these single family neighborhoods.
From a developer's point of view, is there a difference between doing a duplex, triplex, quadruplex versus a 6-unit or an 8-unit townhome development?
A little bit, not to get into the weeds on how these things get financed, but right. Typically you have to borrow money to build some of these things. And so as they get bigger, the check, it gets bigger as well. But from a developer's perspective, the land is so expensive. Being able to get multiple units on land, even if it's 2, does make it more affordable. Now, some of these duplexes are still going to be $300,000-$500,000 at times because they're 2,000-3,000 square feet. But having that housing choice, something between, you know, affordable and high-end, makes a big difference.
Is somebody who can afford to pay $500,000 for a house looking for a duplex or a triplex, or do they expect to get, in this part of the world, a single-family home?
No, you would be a surprise. Lifestyle, whether it's millennials buying their first house, not wanting to take care of a yard, and some of them are making plenty of money to afford $300,000-$500,000 houses, or folks who are now empty nesters who no longer want to deal with the yard. They want a lock and leave situation, mm-hmm. or something less. So absolutely, it is a lifestyle choice, and it's about neighborhoods so they can walk to amenities and shops and things like that.
So Heather, Minneapolis, as you've mentioned, was recently ranked the nation's I thought it was the fourth worst. You said it was the worst for black residents. That was a distinction granted to you by the financial news firm 24/7 Wall Street. and it cited your city's history of restrictive housing covenants and 20th century zoning policies. When Charlotte ranks low in surveys like that, and we have, we get very upset. We launch task forces. We publish studies and sometimes do what those studies recommend. Other times those studies just disappear and sit on a shelf. How did Minneapolis react to those rankings that we've talked about?
Well, it wasn't just the 2040 plan that reacted to that. We, the Minneapolis Chamber helped to establish the Center for Economic Inclusion. We have partners at our Center for Urban and Regional Affairs at the University of Minnesota who have done, who have put on the street a massive study, a 15-year longitudinal study of displacement and gentrification. So it's been an all-hands-on-deck kind of situation here in Minneapolis. Mm-hmm. But I think part of the challenge is that there is a strata of the community that's been very engaged in this conversation, and our residents have not yet been as engaged in this conversation. And so the 2040 plan was a way to really get in front of residents through a community engagement process of almost 250 meetings and really help people understand the history and the legacy of racially biased policies in the cities, and especially in Minneapolis.
And I want to give our listeners an understanding, a clear understanding of just how brave you are, because as the city rolled this out and started conversations about this up in Minneapolis, you were kind of the person conducting a lot of these meetings and taking the notes and listening to what people said. And at one point, Minneapolis or Minnesota Public Radio reported one person at one of these meetings calling you the most hated woman in the city. How controversial was this in Minneapolis?
It was pretty controversial. We had I know that was kind of typical Minnesota understatement, but it was pretty controversial. We had about 18,000 comments on the plan. Not all of them were negative. In fact, towards the end, we kind of thought we were starting to see a trend towards more positive comments. But I think it engaged the city in a way that we never anticipated. And I think that conversation has continued. So, you know, we had a lawsuit filed against us, which was dismissed last week. We've had a number of challenges, and we'll, I'm sure, continue to have challenges. But I think we've engaged our residents, and I think we've started a conversation. And as I said when we were down in Charlotte a few weeks ago, you know, democracy is messy. This is messy work, but it's worthwhile work. And I think it will position us to be a much healthier community for what I like to say is our leading demographic, those five-year-olds in the community right now. We need to be thinking about their future and thinking about the legacy we're leaving for them.
Since democracy is messy, one of the things that makes it messy is the media and the freedom of the press that we have here. You have laid at the feet of the media in Minneapolis a lot of the negative coverage that came out of all of this, because you said they stressed the negatives and ignored a lot of the positive feedback you were hearing from residents. You have some very distinguished and relatively well thought of media outlets in Minneapolis. What did they do wrong?
You know, I don't think they did anything wrong, and that certainly wasn't a holistic comment about the media. We had some good coverage here. We had some bad coverage. I think that's normal. I will say this. I think when it's in your own backyard, you tend to be a little more critical of it. And so I think that's normal. I think that we had some very thoughtful coverage where people engaged, but I think we also had kind of the what I would characterize as some of the drive-by coverage where we just got we got lambasted for sort of truth-telling. And I think that's really challenging. When the data tells you that you have the deepest racial disparities in the nation, that's not something we created. And so that's part of the challenge of doing this work, is to be really, really data-driven in terms of how you present information and not appear to be taking sides. And we were really careful to do that. And so I'd like to think that's helping us kind of weather this.
So I'm going to let you go in a second, but I just want to ask a couple more questions. First of all, I know you're in the beginning stages of this in Minneapolis. You just rolled this out in December, and it's going to take a while for it to bear fruit, I suppose. But in what are now single-family neighborhoods in your city, what other types of construction will you now be permitting, and how will you decide where a triplex goes or a quadruplex, and where do you draw the line? Maybe it becomes 8 units, or maybe it becomes 12 units. Where do you draw the line?
So just really quickly, we began to allow accessory dwelling units or ADUs 2 years ago. We've seen a small increase in the number. They tend to be quite expensive to build. So these are like an apartment building over a garage. You will be able to do any combination of an ADU, duplex, triplex, single family home with an ADU on a single family lot, which in Minneapolis is typically about 40 feet wide. We did not allow fourplexes, or as you call them, quadruplexes. And that was because from a fit standpoint, they did not fit well on a 40-foot lot. And from a financing standpoint, they were more challenging to finance. And we wanted these to actually get built. That's why we ultimately recommended triplexes.
And do you or anybody else in the country that's done this or is considering this know what this does to existing property values?
No, I don't think we know that yet. But we are working with the Federal Reserve of Minneapolis to do a longer-term study of that with our partners at CURA and with the Fed. Hopefully, we will be able to get some data on that. My hunch is that, like other public investments and other investments generally in markets, this will have a positive impact.
Heather Worthington, thank you for joining us. We really appreciate it. Heather is the Director of Long Range Planning for the City of Minneapolis that has eliminated single-family zoning as of December by a 12-to-1 vote on their City Council. Heather, thank you for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thanks, Mike. Have a great day.
You're welcome. We're talking about this because Charlotte is in the middle of their master planning, and we are considering doing this. And Taiwo Jayoba is the planning director of the City of Charlotte. He's here along with community historian Tom Hanchett and Brian Leary, who's the president of commercial and mixed development for Crescent Communities. You've been working on this new master plan, Taiwo, taking a fresh look at how we do things, how we zone things. Was it Minneapolis's decision to do this that led Charlotte to consider doing this, or this has happened in another place you worked, Grand Rapids, Minnesota, just before you left, or just as you were coming into the job? I think it had been decided they were going to do something like this. As I said, the entire state of California, the legislature is considering this. So what led you to consider it here?
A combination of things. First of all, like you said, Grand Rapids considered this just about a year before. They adopted it just about a year before I started there, and okay. I led the bus rapid transit project along what was called the Division Avenue, which was one of the most challenging corridors in Grand Rapids to actually have development. So having that adoption actually helped to tell a story with regards to what will happen along that transit corridor.
Was it controversial there too?
It was not as controversial as Minneapolis' story, but again, Grand Rapids was a smaller city, and the way it was approached was slightly different, but it was pretty much the same outcome.
And Brian Leary, I understand that you help facilitate talks between Charlotte, Grand Rapids, and Minnesota, Minneapolis, Minnesota, on this topic. Why?
Well, I think, there are very few new problems in cities, so we have a lot of great examples across this country to pay attention to import kind of best practices. So let's do what they did right sooner and not do what they did wrong forever. Mm-hmm. So I thought that was a helpful opportunity to do that. We've had 80 plus years of exclusionary zoning, right? When it was first kind of adjudicated in 1926, it was to separate things. We did that for 80 years. And so 50 years after World War II, that it was very auto-centric and supported by a lot of policies that Tom mentioned that encourage kind of sprawl and the separation of people and places. So in many ways, we were getting like the frog being boiled in the water, but not knowing that the heat was being turned up. So now we have the opportunity. I think Taiwo is looking at Minneapolis. He's looking at Grand Rapids. You talk to Raleigh. We talk to cities all over the country. And I don't think he's saying we need to import what California is doing because that's what California is doing, because there is a right solution that is Charlotte-driven because we are a unique place. But it's real easy when you look at the data to see what has happened. Now, it's interesting, you used to be able to say everyone's opinion, they're entitled to their own opinion, but not their own facts. And maybe that's changed recently, kind of with news. But that being said, the data shows you that you can preserve and protect neighborhoods and the vitality of neighborhoods by providing more housing options.
If you provide these housing options, which means greater density, yep. Why does greater density lead to greater affordability?
Well, a couple of things. It's affordability not just for buyers, but also for municipalities. Density is a more efficient way to service folks who live in the city. So if you think about it, back in the days before we had power equipment to dig a hole and build pipe, if you did it by hand, you wanted things close to each other. Now we have the ability to spread things out. And so fast-growing region around the country, whether it's Loudoun County, Virginia, Cherokee County, Georgia, I'm sure Mecklenburg looks at this too, when you spread things out and separate things, it costs a lot more to service them. And so density, first and foremost, is a very affordable way to service citizens. Then from an affordability standpoint, land is unfortunately sometimes 25 to 30% of the cost of a single-family home. Mm-hmm. When land is appreciating so much faster than incomes, it makes it much more supported to put multiple units on the same piece of land.
Spoken like a developer, mm-hmm. which is true, yeah. But the city has other, you have some of the same objectives. You want to make things less expensive, and you want to be able to build and service infrastructure as efficiently as possible. But this city has a commitment, at least according to the mayor and many on council, to finding a way to increase the stock of affordable housing. So I'll ask the same question again. We're going to be adding density. If we go down this road, why does density equal affordability?
That's why you have to look at it as a system, not just look at it as affordable housing units, but you have to look at this as a system. How does this affect public transit? How does location of parks and recreation spaces will enhance communities? So you build more density, usually where you have accessibility to people being able to move, whether you provide bus services or you provide light rail or you provide streetcar, or they have accessibility to full service grocery stores. Usually it costs more, like Brian said, to put density where people can even access services. And so it helps when you have density and accessibility to services close enough. So this has to be looked at as a system, which is what part of the whole comprehensive plan process is that even though it is a city-led effort being led by the planning department, it involves multiple departments within the city and also other agencies outside of the city, such as the county, CMS, and also Parks and Recreation as well. We're talking to police, we're talking to fire, we're talking to solid waste, wastewater, public transit system, to make sure that as we talk about, the premise is that every neighborhood has to have some degree of affordable housing units. If you start with that premise, then we begin to look at it system-wide. How do we make sure that when you provide this, it's not just about putting a building somewhere that's about 1 or 2 miles away from the nearest public transit corridor?
Mike, the other thing on density is that transportation is a very large cost of most people's income. Mm-hmm. So if you can reduce your transportation costs, you can afford more housing.
Brian Leary is president of Commercial and Mixed Development at Crescent Communities. He's here with Tayo Jayoba from the City of Charlotte. And Tom Hanchett, a community historian. We're going to come back and get a little history lesson in a second, among other things. Stay with us at Charlotte Talks on WFAE. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about what Charlotte is considering as they rewrite their planning for the master plan, I guess, and that is doing something with single-family zoning, whether eliminating it altogether or allowing different kind of housing to be mixed in. It's kind of a mixed bag there in terms of how you describe it. Tayo Jayoba is here. He's the planning director for the city. Tom Hanchett is a community historian. Brian Leary is the president of Commercial and Mixed Development for Crescent Communities. We had Richard Rothstein, Tom, on this program a couple of months ago. He's the author of The Color of Law, which is a book that continually is referenced on this. That book alleges that the housing programs begun under the New Deal were tantamount to a state-sponsored system of segregation, and that we suffer what we suffer from today in terms of police shootings and distrust of the police and unrest in the community and the lack of ability to rise above your current financial status. All of that is connected to these New Deal housing policies. And he says that if we want greater equality in this society, if we want a lowering of hostility between police and young African-American men, we need to take steps to desegregate. All of this came from housing policy?
Housing policy, it took me a long time as I was working on this book that became Sorting Out the New South City. Housing policy was made by without a lot of public input, which we do now. And it was made based on the foregoing assumptions of the early 20th century, and that was that there was a place for everyone and everyone in their place, and the more you sorted things out, the better.
But these policies that they're talking about in this book include redlining. That was the
And redlining was the mortgage market froze during the Depression. They said, well, what if we designate certain neighborhoods as good credit risk neighborhoods, and that'll get the mortgage market going again. Well, that was great, but good credit risk meant a white neighborhood that was well-to-do. And so
if you were redlined, you could not get a loan.
It became very difficult to get a loan if you were not in a white neighborhood that was well-to-do.
Restrictive covenants came into being.
The restrictive covenants had popped up in the early 20th century. The redlining reinforced them. And then the Federal Housing Administration, which was a wonderful effort to help banks out of the Depression by guaranteeing long-term loans. The long-term mortgage, the 30-year mortgage, is a New Deal policy. It's wonderful. It's how my dad got his house. But they hired a scholar in Chicago who had the prevailing assumptions, and one of the things he did was to make a list of ethnicities. And if you were from Northern Europe, you were better than if you were Bohemian or Czechoslovakian or Russian Jew of the lower class.
So those are some of the things that we put in place with unintentional and sometimes intentional consequences. Let's be honest about it. Intentional consequences. But also, did Charlotte enact any of its own policies that exacerbated the situation?
Part of the FHA thing was to encourage communities to do planning and to do zoning and to do restrictive covenants. If you wanted FHA funding for your development, you needed to have those in place. And so developers became big advocates for planning, for zoning, as did banks. And all over the United States, zoning is invented in the 1920s. But it really becomes pervasive in the mid-late 40s. Charlotte's first zoning map is 1947. And the areas that are zoned single family are the areas that had been built already as restrictive covenant neighborhoods. And so single family meant a white neighborhood. It didn't say that in the zoning. But
now,
the cumulative effect.
These restrictive covenants existed in places like Myers Park, and specifically it said no black people.
They existed in every single neighborhood that was built between about 1900
and 1950. And you could not sell your house to black people in these neighborhoods. But these covenants also said that when you sell this house, it has to remain single family. Are those still in place?
They did not particularly mention single family in the ones that I'm aware of, but it was for a house costing not less than X number of dollars. And I don't know. I haven't tried that.
There are still a number of them in place. Those that are in violation of federal law, like you know, broad racism, have been kind of struck down. But that is kind of a mixed bag when you buy houses in these neighborhoods.
So in Minneapolis, Heather Worthington, who we just spoke with for a good part of this program, said that part of the challenge in doing this for white people is to understand, part of the challenge for white people to understand is that while they didn't create this situation, they have perpetuated it, and they have the ability to dismantle it. Is this part of the conversation in Charlotte?
It is part of the conversation. I felt that if we will not be honest with ourselves if we do not use the Charlotte Future 2040 Comprehensive Plan as a platform to open this dialogue and begin this conversation about how do we reduce or eliminate racial disparities? How do we deal with the issue of affordable housing? How do we make sure that, I mean, we talk about the 50 out of 50 upward mobility, but not many people know that Charlotte is also the third most economically segregated city in the United States. And so when we have this conversation, it's not just about a particular color versus a particular one, but it's really about geography. We talk about the crescent and the arc, the area where you have the least life expectancy, where you have the lowest income, where you have the most minority, and the wedge where you have the highest income. And so we've got to kind of talk about it in terms of geography
for
as well.
People who are new to Charlotte, the crescent and wedge exist. You can plot it out on a map, and the crescent goes from the north to the west, and it's this crescent of essentially poverty. And the wedge is in South Charlotte, where you have a high-density population of well-to-do people.
And I'll quickly point out also that the Crescent or the Hack is also where you have the most industrially zoned land as well. And that's where you have developers who typically go to want to rezone those.
So when you talk to property owners about something that you want to change about zoning, the first thing they want to know is what is this going to do to my property values? And I asked Heather what she thought it would do, and she didn't know the answer. Do you?
That's one of the questions that we have actually had from our planning commissioners in terms of, as you do this, you also want to make sure that you're subject to some economic analysis and some market study, which is really part of our comprehensive plan process. We're in a phase right now where we're developing some growth scenario model, and at some point we will subject this to economic analysis in terms of what exactly does that do to value. We know that when you invest in communities, when communities are integrated, they are more sustainable. Values go up, not down. Like we said, I mean, how many people can say the values have gone down in Dilworth or maybe Plaza Midwood
well,
or Elizabeth?
When the mayor was on this program last week, she specifically mentioned Dilworth. Yeah. And I've done some reading in Plaza Midwood, this kind of development years ago where we had single-family homes and duplexes and triplexes and quadruplexes on the corners and things like that. This is not a new idea. Mm-hmm. And this is a way, she says, to bring affordability to every price point. How does allowing duplexes, you're a developer, Brian, how does allowing duplexes and triplexes bring affordability?
Well, a couple of things. Again, it comes back to that land cost. So say with a single lot on a corner, a half acre, many of these neighborhoods would have one home for $750,000 or more. If you have three homes on that same property and maybe you sell them for $300,000, the developer actually can...
But does that happen? I live in a neighborhood where there are a lot of teardowns, mm-hmm. and where a $500,000 home maybe existed, built in the 1960s, it existed there last week, it's gone. And in its place, they're putting up three houses that each sell for $1.3 million or more.
That's the private market at work there,
exactly
right?
Exactly right. So that's my point. When you open this door and to a developer to say, oh, you don't have to just build one house here. You can put three or four houses on the – what's to prevent those – what's to make those houses affordable?
Well, I'm a big believer in incenting good behavior, right? And so I think from a zoning perspective –
But that's the point. We have incentives, and developers don't generally take advantage of them. And we have no – I don't know if Minneapolis does, but Charlotte has no – tools in its toolkit to say you must do this.
We cannot do that at a state
level. Does Minneapolis have that in their toolkit?
They are also Dillon's rule state, but they have some level of flexibility in terms of what they do with regards to Minnesota as a state compared to what we can do with regards to us in North Carolina. However, though, we do have incentives that we're going to be rolling out. We started the first phase of that through our transit-oriented development in terms of incentivizing developers. If you do this particular thing for public benefits, we will incentivize you to be able to get this. And I think that as Minneapolis goes into their own mapping, because they have to now do a zoning for the entire, they have to do zoning change or zoning mapping for the entire city, there will be some incentives built into that to make sure that the adopted policies become implemented. I know Tom wants to...
Accessory dwelling unit change is maybe a leading edge of this in a way to see what's possible, what's going to happen. And I don't know any of the details, but I know that a few years ago, Charlotte allowed accessory dwelling units, garage apartment, mother-in-law apartment, whatever you want to call it, in most areas with single-family zoning. Am I saying the right thing?
Yes.
Okay. And I live in Plaza Midwood, and I notice a lot of these are going in. And because it's a maximum of 800 square feet, they are much more affordable as a rental space than a 2,000-square-foot house in my neighborhood. And so I have not noticed values in Plaza Midwood going down one bit ever since that happened.
Okay. Yeah. And it also depends on how you roll this out. We may roll this out by saying that, if you are a developer, because sometimes we look at developers and real estate speculators and we think that they are the ones to blame. Sometimes it's neighborhoods themselves who are opposing this because they're not sure what it would do to me, right, at the end of the day. We may roll this out and say you're only going to deal with vacant properties rather than tear down buildings that are in existence. But How we do that, the mechanism of that, is something we still have to work out.
So the state of California as a whole, the legislature there, is considering doing something that we're talking about right now. And according to the New York Times, opponents of statewide legislation there argue that allowing more multifamily buildings in single-family zoned areas would actually reduce affordable housing because it would increase housing prices where more development is permitted and where developers will mostly build high-end units. Brian, what will make developers and builders decide to build units that have different price point opportunities and, in fact, be affordable for working people?
You know, the free and private market does not incent developers to do mixed income housing. It does not. And there is a delta between the cost to build and the affordability of folks that can do that. So we believe in this as an organization, Crescent Communities. We are donating $2 million of land in the heart of the River District that we talked about a couple years ago to make sure that there's mixed income housing on day one in the middle of that. But I think you have to bridge that gap, and that's something that the city has really taken lead on. Mayor Lyles has really led the region on this, and now there's close to $150 million that have been raised for it.
So let's just give you the benefit of the doubt and say that Crescent Communities is a good guy. Knight in shining armor.
Appreciate it.
White hat on the white stallion.
Right.
Not everybody's like you.
Right.
So what safeguards can be put in place if you do this that will also allow the city to be true to its desire for more affordable housing, since you have no tools in the toolkit?
We actually have some tools that we're refining right now, or at least we're learning best practices from other communities. It could be, how can we expedite? If you come in and you have a particular percentage of AMI or percentage of a building that will be dedicated to affordable housing, we can expedite process for you. We can waive fees. We can, pretty much put you on top of the stack to make sure you go through. Because at the end of the day, what cost, outside of the cost of land, time is everything to a developer.
Would most developers bite?
So it's interesting you asked about the toolbox. In his toolbox, he doesn't have a hammer, but he has more carrot. And so I think developers, what we want is predictability, particularly on time. And so when you look at those places of high desirability, a long transit, or in some of these neighborhoods where, for instance, you've seen some attempts at densification in places like Myers Park get thwarted by the neighborhood, if a developer knew that the city was supportive and would expedite a rezoning process to add density and would be able to get through the process, they would do this. In fact, it's being done across the country. Bethesda, Maryland, and Fairfax County, Virginia are very high-end, affluent, highly educated places, and they do it.
We don't practice redlining today. We don't allow special covenants or deed restrictions anymore to be written to keep certain people out. And yet today, nationally, the home ownership rate for African Americans is 43% in the last quarter of 2018, compared to 74% for whites, according to the Census Bureau. If the lifting of those roadblocks has not helped increase the or reverse the impact of racism, how will ending single-family zoning do that?
I would say it's taken years for us to get to this point. It's going to take us years to dismantle it. We may not have redlining today, but there are still areas where we've perpetuated that policies that are past policies that pretty much shaped the way we are today. It's going to take a while.
I only have a minute left. A lot of this is no longer based on racism. It's based on economics.
Income.
So how do you convince somebody who's just spent $800,000 or $1 million on a house that they're going to want a triplex next door? I don't care what that triplex costs. How do you fix the economics of this? How do you let somebody who can only afford a $200,000 home own one of those units in that triplex?
It's incremental. I think that's, and it's not a silver bullet. You need a comprehensive approach to this.
Last week on this program, Mayor Lyles essentially said that if we want the kind of growth we're experiencing, everyone needs to benefit. That's almost precisely what Heather Worthington from Minneapolis once said. She said, as their city grows, everyone must benefit from that growth. Historically, not everyone in Minneapolis has. That's certainly true of Charlotte. Is that goal achievable? I have 20 seconds.
So I was going to say that everyone, the whole notion of equity is that you could be living in a $1 million home today, mm-hmm. but tomorrow you might find that you need to move into a $200,000 home.
Where do we stand right now on this decision?
On this decision, we're having a conversation with the community as to how we go with this.
Taiwo Jayoba is the planning director for the city of Charlotte. Brian Leary with Crescent Communities. Tom Hanchett, our community historian. Thank you all for the hour. Charlotte Talks is sponsored by Mazda of South Charlotte, dedicated to helping customers select vehicles that fit one's lifestyle. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.